Does the departure of Mali, Burkina Faso, and Niger from the Economic Community of West African States represent a blow to French and American imperialist domination of the African continent? What exactly sparked the current Sudanese civil war? How is the recent successes of the M23 rebel group linked to precious minerals like coltan and tin? Are the several states led by Kenya performing repression of democratic resistance in Haiti under the cover of protecting people from dangerous gangs? This week on the Global Research News Hour, in the first week of Black History Month, we are profiling major incidents around the world affecting black people struggling against white supremacist imperialist control. In our first half hour, Abiyomi Azikiwe joins us to talk about what caused people in the Sahel states running through the heart of Africa to turn their backs on the French and American interests acting in their own interests. We also have him explain the dynamics behind the 18-month civil war erupting in Sudan. In our second half hour, we are joined by Judy Reaver, who speaks to us about how Rwanda and its links with the U.S. and EU is responsible for the latest developments in Goma, DRC. Finally, we are joined by the Haitian-Canadian Jeffrey Kaiti to explain the bigger white supremacist picture behind the current so-called humanitarian mission in the western end of the Hispaniola Island. On this week's program, Black History Month edition, the struggle continues in the Sahel, Sudan, the Congo, and Haiti. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of February 7th, 2025. The program is funded by the Center for Research on Globalization and produced in collaboration with campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. I'm your host, Michael Welch. The show seeks to provide listeners with access to analysis of some of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our shows are available to partner radio stations across Canada and the United States and available for streaming or download at the site globalresearch.com. We acknowledge that this program was produced on the traditional territory of the Anishinaabe, the Innu, the Ojibwe, the Dene, and the Dakota, the birthplace of the Métis Nation, the heart of the Métis Nation homeland. Just like black people, marginalized by white supremacy, the indigenous people have also been unfairly cheated out of the resources by European settlers who secured the ability, by hook or by crook, to secure the land and waters first and foremost to capitalist use. In the spirit of mutual respect moving into the future, let us correct these injustices and move forward as partners. Now it's time for News Notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. Listeners should know that some of the articles may run against common messaging about sensitive subjects and are not all endorsed by this radio station. Trump hopes to reduce the U.S.-China trade disequilibrium by imposing tariffs on Chinese-made imports. What he does is putting a stick in the wheels of U.S. industries depending on imports from China, thereby slowing the U.S. economy and U.S. consumer goods becoming more expensive, contributing to U.S. inflation, the very affliction he promised during his campaign to fight as number one priority. On a political level, imposing tariffs on countries he does not agree with is outright blackmail. Will Trump blackmail Canada into becoming the 51st state of the United States by his announced 25% tariffs for Canadian goods? In Mexico, under another 25% tariff threat, President Claudia Sheinbaum promised to deploy 10,000 National Guard members to 18 cities along the U.S.-Mexico border as part of a deal to delay U.S. tariffs. That comes from the article, President Trump's Obsession with Tariffs, Economic Ruse or Political Blackmail, by Peter Koenig, posted February 6th. The political West and its neo-Nazi puppets are responsible for keeping this satellite state afloat. However, with the United States under Donald Trump embracing an increasingly Palestinian policy toward the Kiev regime, the European parts of NATO and its geopolitical pendant, the EU, will be responsible for financing the state apparatus. With dwindling funds, this bureaucracy will become unviable, and if Russia were to suddenly launch a massive offensive and retake Ukraine, it would also have to shoulder this burden. Not to mention that this state apparatus has been vetted to include only those who are Russophobic to the core, so the Kremlin would effectively be feeding the dog that has been biting its hand. As a result, Moscow is in no hurry to end the NATO-orchestrated Ukrainian conflict and is willing to wait as long as it takes. That comes from the article, Why Russia Doesn't, quote, just end, unquote, the Ukrainian conflict immediately, by Drago Bosnick, posted February 5th, originally published on InfoBricks. Trump's order not only directs federal agencies to stop issuing citizenship documents to U.S.-born children of undocumented mothers, it applies to mothers in the country on temporary visas if the father isn't a citizen or permanent resident. According to a lawsuit filed by 18 states, there are about 150,000 children born each year to two parents who are non-citizens and lack legal status. California Attorney General Rob Bonta estimates the order would affect more than 20,000 newborns each year, 5% of the babies born in that state annually. In the past, the Supreme Court has described citizenship as the most basic of all rights, a, quote, priceless possession, unquote. The opening clause of the 14th Amendment was designed principally to grant both national and state citizenship to the newly free blacks. That comes from the article, Trump revoking birthright citizenship is derailing the engine of American liberty, by Greg Guma, posted February 6th, originally published on the author's blog. Unless he changes course, he will be brought down by corruption throughout his ranks, plunging polls, resistance by many states and their attorneys general, and finally by a congressional GOP realizing that it is their political skin or Trump's. They will choose their own political survival. Remember, during the Watergate scandal in 1974, a delegation of Republican senators went to the White House and told Richard Nixon that his time was up and that he had to resign for far, far fewer transgressions. Trump knows no boundaries, no self-restraint, and has often declared that he will do whatever he wants, meaning operating in massive violation of the laws of our land. He is now ruling by dictates that are getting more sweeping and penetrating by the day. That comes from the article, Underestimating Americans, a Coming Plunge of, quote, Dictator Donald, unquote, D.D. Ralph Nader, by Ralph Nader, posted February 6th, originally published on Ralph Nader's website. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. This week, we're going to be turning our attention to Africa, and we're going to focus very much on the developments in the Sahel states, that belt running right through the middle of the continent. And here to talk to me is none other than Abiyomi Azikiwe. He is a historian, journalist, a chief editor of Pan-African Newswire, and a frequent contributor both to Black Agenda Report and to Global Research. Thank you for being available for a conversation, Abiyomi.
Well, thanks again for the invitation.
Mali, Burkina Faso, and Niger are leaving the Economic Community of West African States, or ECOWAS. Could you tell me how significant will this development be from the standpoint of the French and the Americans who sought to continue to dominate the region within their imperialist grasp?
In 2008, the United States Africa Command, AFRICOM, went into operation. And since that time period, there's been a growing presence of U.S. as well as French military forces on the African continent. In regard to Mali, it was a former French colony. It is a landlocked country. And since the destruction of the North African state of Libya, instability in North Africa and West Africa has accelerated. Now, in 2012, fighting began once again between the Tuareg people of the northern part of Mali and the central government. This was not a new phenomenon. This has been going on since the early 1960s. These were unresolved issues from the French colonial period. And then, as a result of that, it opened the way for other Islamist and so-called jihadist organizations to come into northern Mali as well. France sent in their own military forces, ostensibly to drive back and to destroy the rebel organizations operating in the north and, to a certain extent, the central part of the country. Well, after a decade, it was quite clear that this policy was not working. In 2020, there was a military coup in Mali, which overthrew a civilian government, which was heavily allied with France. Some of the military personnel who were involved in this coup d'etat had close ties with both the French military as well as the Pentagon. But after a while, I think the realization began to set in that the presence of these troops correlated with the escalation in jihadist violence in Mali. This violence had spread to Burkina Faso, Niger, and to a lesser extent to other states in the region. So, what has happened since the coup in 2020 in Mali, and then, of course, there was another one 2 years later. Then, of course, the coup in Burkina Faso, and later in Niger. These took place in 2022 and 2023. So, France's reaction, the reaction of the Economic Community of West African States, which is closely allied with both France and the United States, was initially not only to impose sanctions and a virtual blockade on the country, but they wanted to send in a military force to overthrow the CNSP government in Niamey, which is the capital of Niger. And of course, the outrage throughout the region prevented that from happening. So these are some of the dynamics that have led to the current situation. France agreed to withdraw their troops from Niger. So did the United States, which had a drone station there. And also, the uranium interests is under reconsideration right now as well. Niger has some of the largest deposits of uranium in the world. So this is what's going on right now in the Sahel region. They formed the AES, and this coalition has drawn the attention of progressive forces throughout Africa and also throughout the African diaspora. There have been delegations that have gone to Niger, that have gone to Burkina Faso. In Ouagadougou, the capital of Burkina Faso, they have established a Thomas Sankara Center. And that center is doing a lot of great work in terms of promoting the ideas of African unity and anti-imperialism. So that gives you an idea of what's been happening in the Sahel region in West Africa over the last several years.
When the Libyan government was overthrown in 2011 by NATO, I'm wondering if that may have been, added to the, that Pan-African sentiments.
Exactly. And Colonel Gaddafi had taken the lead in regard to advocating African unity. And he, at one point in 2009, was chair of the African Union. when the African Union transitioned from the Organization of African Unity in 2002, the initial discussions around that took place in Sirte, in Libya. And they issued a declaration. People can read it even today, the Sirte Declaration, which led to the reform within the African Union. And of course, the combined efforts of the U.S. Central Intelligence Agency, NATO, also the allies of NATO, people like who are in control in Saudi Arabia, Qatar, they all participated in the destruction of Libya, sending in special forces, rebel groups, which were given cover by the massive airstrikes that were carried out against Libya between March and October of 2011, killing anywhere between 50 to 100,000 people, also displacing 2 million people and reducing Libya, which was the most prosperous country in the on the African continent, to one of the most destitute and divided. Today, it is overrun by all types of criminal elements. There's all types of human trafficking that is going on there. And they have failed 14 years, and they have not been able to create a unified central government in Libya. So the displacement in Libya, the breakdown of civil society in the state, the Libyan state, created displacement into Mali and into other states. And of course, the CIA and France undoubtedly are behind these jihadists and rebel groups. That was uncovered last year in Mali when they revealed that the Ukrainians, which are being propped up by the United States, were in fact training these rebel groups and giving them logistical advice in regard to how to destabilize Mali. And I'm sure that's happening in other states as well.
Are you saying with the degree to which the U.S. Is instigating a lot of this, are they trying to take over and sweep up the remains of the French empires for themselves?
Yes, but I don't believe it's going to work, because even in countries like Senegal, for example, which had elections last year, initially did not appear to be heading in the same direction as the Alliance of Sahel States. Nonetheless, they did declare several months ago they wanted all foreign troops out of Senegal. Same situation in Chad, and also, surprisingly enough, in Cote d'Ivoire, in Ivory Coast. Now, the Ivory Coast government that's in power now was actually installed by French paratroopers in 2011, around the same time as the destruction of Libya and the initial rebellion that was instigated by the imperialists as well in Syria. So all of this was taking place simultaneously, but today they're saying they want the French troops to leave Ivory Coast as well. And I don't believe that the United States has the capacity at this point to stabilize any of these states, because they in fact want, they really want the minerals, they want the metals, they want the strategic agricultural corridors and the strategic waterways off the coast of West Africa. They want to dominate those, but it's going to be very difficult, because they have to contend with the Russian Federation, they have to contend with China, and other countries that are attempting to form alliances all across the African continent. In order for there to be unity, genuine unity on the continent, there has to be a struggle waged against imperialism. There's no other alternative, in my view. The African Continental Free Trade Area is based in Ghana. They're attempting to form some type of inter-African trading and economic network. But that's going to be impossible as long as the imperialists can actively disrupt what these countries are doing in regard to economic development. And also internally, if they are funding these rebel groups, opposition groups, to destabilize the countries. And when the countries are destabilized, that provides a rationale for the imperialists to come in and dictate the terms of any type of national agreement, or continue the unrest, and it will be more advantageous for them to, in fact, bring about their enrichment and the further impoverishment and underdevelopment of those living on the African continent.
people of the region, well, what do they have to do so that they will achieve actual autonomy from, may say, U.S. and French influence, as opposed to anything sort of like a fake autonomy, so to speak?
Well, they have to have a clear position against imperialism. The historical relationship between the Western capitalist countries and the so-called developing countries, or today they are often referred to as the Global South. They have to organize, they have to unify, and they have to be willing to defend their land, their mineral resources, and their people. I don't think declaring that Africa needs to unite, Africa needs to integrate economically, because that's totally in opposition to the aims and objectives of the United States, of Britain, of the European Union. So in order for that to succeed, the African people, through their leadership and organization, have to be willing to struggle against the imperialist system. Now, we've seen that clearly in other parts of the world, whether it's in Latin America. West Asia is a good example in terms of what has been happening in Palestine, in Lebanon, and other countries, Yemen. So people have to be willing to struggle in order to bring about genuine unity and sovereignty of the continent.
I want to go a little further east now to Sudan. The Sudanese, they've been in a civil war of sorts since August of 2023. How did that start, and what kind of foreign interference, if any, is benefiting from it?
Well, we have to go back to some of the political turmoil that has been taking place in Sudan, particularly since late 2018, when there was a huge economic crisis. Many people went out on strike. They engaged in mass demonstrations. This went on for 4 or 5 months, and it was obvious that the current Sudanese state at that time could not maintain control over the society. So the then president, al-Bashir, was overthrown by his fellow military officers that have been a part of the Sudanese state. The military Transitional Military Council that was formed after April of 2019 hoped that the overthrow of Omar Hassan al-Bashir would, in fact, quell the concerns of the masses inside of Sudan. That did not happen. People continued to organize and demand a return to multi-party democratic rule. And of course, that has been a major issue that divided the military from the Sudanese Professional Association, other groups, the FF, Forces for Freedom and Change. And of course, there have been divisions going on since 2019. Then, of course, there was a coup, initial coup that overthrew the interim Prime Minister, Abdalla Hamdok, in late 2022. And then, of course, in 2023, there was the eruption of a war between the Rapid Support Forces, which is a paramilitary force that grew out of the struggle in Darfur. Between the central government in Sudan and the rebels in the Darfur area, and the Sudanese Armed Forces, which is the conventional military force for the country. And they've been fighting since April 15th of 2023. It'll soon be 2 years and another couple of months. And the destruction has been massive, particularly in North Darfur and around the capital of Khartoum and Omdurman. And of course, we've seen in recent days the SAF, headed by the military chief, he has Al-Burhan, he has made advances over the last several weeks in beating back the RSF. But who knows if this is going to be sustainable or not. But the country, which was in dire straits even prior to the eruption of the fighting in 2023, is in far worse shape now. More people have been dislocated. People have fled as refugees into Chad, into Egypt, into South Sudan. And efforts to bring about some type of peaceful diplomatic solution have failed. So It's not clear exactly what's going to happen over the next few months in the Republic of Sudan. But as long as you have this type of division going on between the military elements, and this is why it was so important, the popular mass struggles that took place were extremely important because they wanted to remove the military from the principal organs of the state, which they have dominated, even the economy, the banking sector, international trade has been heavily dominated by military forces for decades in Sudan. So this has prevented any type of democratic transition inside the country due to the conflict between these two major military factions inside of Sudan. So if the SAF is able to defeat the RSF, that may solve part of the problem in the short term, but it still does not solve the long-term problem of actual development and the democratic process that needs to resume inside of Sudan.
From the standpoint of U.S. or foreign interference, do they benefit from the ongoing nature of the fight, or do they want one side or the other to win?
Well, they wanted initially to bring Sudan very close into the Western imperialist camp. During Trump's first administration, he pressured Abdallah Hamdok, this was in 2020, to, in fact, sign an agreement normalizing relations with the state of Israel. And this was even in contravention of the Sudanese constitution. In 1958, just 2 years after the country got its national independence, the parliament there passed an Israeli boycott act, which prohibits the state of Sudan from having any type of normalized relations with the state of Israel. This was done as early as 1958. And Hamdok had no authority whatsoever to exercise that decision. And of course, that has fallen apart largely because of the Al-Aqsa flood, which started in October of 2023. And then, of course, with the conflict, inner Sudanese conflict between the RSF and the SAF, has also slowed down and really neutralized that whole process. So prior to that, even under al-Bashir, they were transporting and shipping weapons and other supplies to the people in Gaza that were being utilized by the resistance to fight against Tel Aviv. And so it was quite a contradiction under the latter days of the Trump administration to actually pressure the interim prime minister to accept normalized relations with the state of Israel. Sudan can never benefit in that regard. That's why there needs to be a democratic government there that's revolutionary, that can, in fact, put the country on a proper course, both domestically and internationally.
Abiyomi Ezekwe is a historian, journalist, and the chief editor of Pan-African Newswire. On January 27th, 2025, the MT-23 rebel group, backed by Rwanda, captured the city of Goma in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo. This is yet another flare-up in the forgotten war that has claimed the lives of no less than 6 million people since 1996. My next guest will share her thoughts about what is going on in this situation and where it is heading. Judy Reaver is a Montreal-based freelance print and broadcast journalist. Her reporting on Rwanda has been featured in 7 front-page stories in the Globe and Mail. Her 2018 book, In Praise of Blood, The Crimes of the Rwandan Patriotic Front, published by Random House Canada, received high praise and made her a finalist for the Hillary Weston Writers Trust Prize for Nonfiction. Judy Reaver joins me after this brief break. Please stay tuned. You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcasting from CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and from partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. Judy, welcome back to the Global Research News Hour.
Thanks for having me.
Has the violence toward the Congo individuals seen a massive increase in recent years, or has it merely been a more intense continuation of the killings by the Rwandan front over 20 years ago?
Well, the latest military aggression By Rwanda has been going on for 3 years now, but it's part of a three-decade campaign of violence, more or less 3 decades in neighboring Congo. But over the last 10 days, with the takeover of Goma, as you mentioned, in eastern Congo, we've seen dramatic escalation in the bloodshed. So we have Rwandan defense troops and their militia called the M23. We've seen them take over the provincial capital. Already 1.7 million people were displaced in the northern Kivu province, and hundreds of thousands of displaced people who were set up in tents around that city are uprooted and on the run now. The humanitarian situation is dire. So the latest reports are 900 people have been killed in the fighting between the Rwandan led and controlled militia and on the other side, Congolese troops who are defending their nation and who are supported by South African soldiers belonging to the SADC, that's the South African Defense Community, peacekeeping force. So the Burundians are involved as well, helping the Congolese. But basically the bodies are littered on the streets or were littered on the streets of Goma after that city was laid siege to, and the morgues and hospitals have filled up. 3,000 people at least are injured, and the Rwandan and M23 forces were heading towards Bukavu in the south. So, I mean, that's the state of affairs, but there's a cyclical aspect to the violence. So Paul Kagame, the leader, has sponsored a succession of militias over the last 3 decades. And there's this recursive nature to the crimes there. Really the problem is the nexus is Rwanda's attempt to expand the territory under its control and get permanent access to the valuable minerals that it has actually trafficked off and on since the late 90s.
Well, what about those vital minerals you're talking about? Which ones in particular? And how is that connected overall to the violence we're seeing today?
Well, you know, Congo in many ways is where the economy, the world economy begins. It has an estimated $24 trillion in natural resources. It's the biggest producer of cobalt in the world, which is essential for powering modern technology. But Rwanda's role in particular is linked to the trafficking of something called 3T minerals and gold. So 3Ts, that's tantalum, tungsten, and tin. Rwanda produces very little 3T itself, yet Rwanda's one of the biggest exporters in the world of coltan, and whose derivative is tantalum. Okay, so tantalum is what is at issue here. It's a mineral that it's a metal that's heat resistant and stores lots of energy that is essential for the fabrication of components for defense applications and components used in cell phones, computers, and aviation systems. So tantalum helps run our world economy. So Western tech companies buy these components and they buy minerals from global suppliers. The suppliers are refiners, smelters, and processors. And those companies purchase directly from Rwanda. I mean, they purchase to some extent from Congo, but the preferred area to purchase or country to purchase from is surreally Rwanda. And so China's also a big buyer of tantalum from Rwanda. So, and now there's more attention being leveled at all these entities that are commercializing illegally exploited minerals. And so they're being accused of being complicit in the violence. So, you know, Rwanda obviously is very much what was very much interested in getting permanent access to those minerals. There's one area in eastern Congo in Masisi, which is a region, a town called Rubaya, which is essentially ground zero for the production of coltan, of tantalum, the derivative. And Kagame's militia basically seized that that location, that area last year. So this really is the core of the problem.
I know that I guess in addition to what you said, I mean, coltan is necessary for laptops, cell phones, and GPS instruments, and I see where the United States and China have an interest. I mean, can you see any means by which they are actually supporting these efforts, I guess secretly, either financially or otherwise?
Well, I would say that these countries and Western companies and also China, they have turned a blind eye. And so they're silent and complicit. I mean, you know, the UN Security Council and Washington and London and Germany and France and even Canada express concern about the violence, but they've done nothing to stop it. And, you know, Kagame and this whole network, the global supply chain and how it plays out, the dynamics, is very useful to the West because the West and China as well are getting those minerals, which are in abundance, in steady supply and in cheap for cheap because of the current setup. Even though there are, I would say, cosmetic attempts to sanitize and you know clean up the supply chain and on the surface claim that the minerals are not blood minerals, that they're not linked to violence. So there have been attempts to show the world and to reassure consumers that whatever is going into their cell phone, whatever consumers purchase, is not fueling these atrocities. So there are attempts, but really, everyone who has been documenting this and who understands Central Africa and the economics knows that it is, in fact, fueling the bloodshed. And so what we've seen in the last 10 days is we've seen the UN and the U, you know, the UK and Washington express their concern, but do nothing to stop Kagame. So that the Congolese are very much aware of this. And it's astounding and it's devastating because the Congolese government has asked the UN Security Council and UN member states to slap, at least, at the very least, slap an embargo against Rwanda, stop Kagame, an arms embargo, stop a boycott Rwandan exported minerals in order to remove that incentive for the fueling of these atrocities, and level at least individual sanctions. Like they have against Putin, against Kagame and his top senior commanders, who UN investigators have clearly shown with evidence from satellites and from drones and everything that, you know, Rwanda is controlling and steering this rebellion. So these are easy steps to take, but the West, but the UN won't do it. So, it's pretty devastating, and we don't really know where this is going, but we're certainly we see the complicity in the violence now.
Tell us about the M23 rebels. They have another purpose besides what they say of protecting Tutsis from the Hutu genocidaires.
Yeah, that's what Kagame has long stated. He's justified his military forays in Congo with the pretext that Rwanda's security is in danger, is endangered by Hutu elements that were responsible for the genocide against Tutsis in 1994. But that was like 30 years ago, and the men he's actually referring to are likely not alive today, or they're too old to fight. So the reality for many years now is that in any Hutu force, in this case, Kagame is referring to what is known as the FDLR. That's an acronym. The FDLR poses no real military threat to Rwanda. Many FDLR forces have been caught or were caught years ago, or their members willingly repatriated under disarmament campaigns and demobilization campaigns, and then they were re-enrolled in Kagame's army and sent back to Congo and wage war there on behalf of the Rwandan Defense Force. So, I mean, and I remember speaking to Hank Cohen, who used to be the U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for Africa, and he said very clearly to me that Hutu FDLR forces in Congo are a very useful tool for Kagame to justify his expansion and his presence and his attempts to get minerals. So, I mean, that's a lot of propaganda. Now, the M23 you asked about, they're a mixture of Congolese Tutsis and Rwandan fighters. This is a militia that was in 2012 and 13 led initially by Kagame's nastiest at the time warlord. His name was Bosco Ntaganda, who was convicted, by the way, in The Hague for crimes against humanity. At that time, more than a decade ago, the M23 was effectively neutralized by a UN intervention brigade in 2013, but it's now come back with it with ferocity. So the UN investigators are clear now, like Rwanda controls and steers M23 operations. So you know, M23 is really an extension of the Rwandan Defense Force.
Okay, we got about a minute left. Could you just maybe say where you think this situation will be headed in the near future?
Well, everyone is very afraid of a real regional war. I mean, the scale possibly of past wars we've seen in the late 1990s, early 2000s, maybe not as big, but it's a prospect on everyone's lips. Burundi's president, Ndayishimiye evoked the possibility several days ago. His troops are helping Congo, so it's dire. And I think right now there seems to be a ceasefire since yesterday in place, but Kagame's troops and their M23 allies were pushing towards the south, towards Bukavu, and its political arm was claiming they want to go all the way to Kinshasa.
Judy Reaver is a freelance journalist and the author of In Praise of Blood. She spoke to us from Montreal. In October of 2023, the Multinational Security Support Mission in Haiti was approved by the UN Security Council in order to restore law and order amid worsening civil strife and gang violence since 2018. The first troops were dispatched in June of last year, and as of the 3rd of January 2025, over 500 personnel from Kenya, Jamaica, Belize, the Bahamas, Guatemala, and El Salvador have been deployed to Haiti. We wanted to probe this so-called mission of mercy with a regular contributor who has his eyes on Canadian, US, and UN-approved missions to his country of origin, which a country which in 1805 you could say wrote the book on anti-imperialism. Geoffrey Kaiti, also known as Jean Sainville, is an Ottawa-based author, radio host, and social justice activist who publishes in English, Creole, and French on his blog, geoffreykaiti.com. He continually calls on Canada to stop interfering in the governance of his native Haiti. Thank you for joining us again on the Global Research NewsHour.
Thank you for inviting me again, Michael.
The Kenyan forces dispatched to clean up gangster warfare in Haiti. This crusade does not include the US or Canada, unlike the mission from 2004, which kidnapped Aristide, the democratically elected leader of the country. Do you suppose they learned a lesson from those times to get, black-faced individuals doing the dirty work the second time around?
Unfortunately, not, Michael. It seems like There is this desire to use Haiti constantly as a laboratory to test more imperialist invasions for other places, other parts of the world. That's the only way we could understand this desire to invade Haiti with troops coming from Kenya, like you mentioned, and places like Belize, the Bahamas. I mean, places where absolutely, they do not have the ability to address the issue, and clearly, it's a mobilization of mercenaries with the promise of money from the United States, Canada, to fund them. But there's also a lot of bluff in this whole thing because the troops that were announced never arrived. They're still under 1,000, whereas they were talking about over 3,000 soldiers or police officers, etc., and equipment. And as we speak, the situation in Haiti is such that the terrorists who have encircled the capital city are continuing to take more territory, and there's internal displacement in the country as there's never been before. And so the presence of nearly now 1,000 foreign troops in Haiti has not at all improved the quality of life of Haitians. But what they have done is secure the U.S. embassy, a place that was already secure. So a lot of people are asking themselves, what is really going on here?
Well, they say the mission is to protect people from the violent gangs. I mean, could you say a little bit more about what these forces are really doing in Haiti?
Well, there were a lot of criticisms because when there was a switch in terms of governance, there's a transitional council in Haiti, and the person who's leading it now, Leslie Voltaire, made the point that he doesn't have any connections with these criminal terrorists, therefore he's going to go after them, and he started to go after them, and there started to be talk of a marriage between the population and the police, and they did eliminate a number of the terrorists through community activism, people who basically stand on guard for their community and work hand in hand with the police, and because the judicial system itself has also been taken over by the PHTK or the Parti Haïtien Tête Calée, led by Michel Martelly, which the Clintons imposed on Haiti after the earthquake in 2010, people don't trust the judicial system. So many of the terrorists who get neutralized by police and the population end up being lynched by the population. You can see that this is not something that can be sustainable in a country. Sooner or later, there's going to be people who are going to abuse those opportunities to, murder people that they don't like when they don't have anything to do necessarily with the terrorist activities. So now this was happening, but it. You cannot really say that there's been a major turnaround because what's happening is that within that governing body of that's called the Conseil Présidentiel de Transition, they forced many political parties to cohabit. And some of these folks are known to have been part of the criminal regime that the Clintons had imposed on Haiti since 2011. And the latest that this happened a couple of days ago, Jimmy Cherizier Barbecue, this former policeman who's the spokesperson for the terrorists that they usually refer to them as gangs, he basically went on the air and identified some of these politicians who were part of the PHTK regime, namely Claude Joseph, who were part of the folks sitting down at in Jamaica with the CARICOM to decide, who's going to be part of the transitional government of Haiti. And now the head, the spokesperson for the terrorist who wants to be recognized as a political party, went on the air explaining in fine detail how he was being paid by Claude Joseph, who was then prime minister, because of his own implication in the assassination of Jovenel Moïse. And he paid the, that's the accusation, that he paid Barbecue and his terrorists so that they don't demonstrate in the streets after the killing of Jovenel Moïse, because Jovenel Moïse was close to the terrorist and they knew that his prime minister, Claude Joseph, was from the same party as him, the PHTK, was implicated in the assassination of Jovenel Moïse. What they didn't say, that is, with U.S. complicity, because as has been observed, after the assassination of Jovenel Moïse, a strange situation where it's the FBI that went into Haiti, conducted its own investigation, went to the crime scene, took evidence, and even some of the folks who were found to be guilty in the assassination of Jovenel Moïse, they were taken to the United States. And you had a judge in the United States saying that they need to put a gag order on some of the proceedings of the court in order to protect national security of the United States. You know, I mean, this is a way of saying that the United States was implicated, through companies like the CTU that is based in Florida, and the Haitian oligarchs who are based in Florida, who used Jovenel Moïse as a puppet president, and then when he was no longer useful to them, decided to kill him. And so there is a lot to unpack in what's happening in Haiti today, and certainly mercenaries coming from Kenya, because Samuel Ruto wants to buy the favor of the West, is not going to solve anything, but rather make this mess a little bit more complicated and more difficult for the Haitian population to do what it takes to solve a problem that affects them primarily.
You, when we've spoken in the past, you talked about hierarchy, or at the top of the hierarchy are a few white families. Mm-hmm. And, as long as that's in place, I mean, nothing's going to change. I will point out, however, that Global Affairs Canada in December of 2022 listed Gilbert Bigeau, mm-hmm. Reynald Deeb, and Sherif Abdullah as the target of sanctions in December of 2022. The Global Affairs Canada said the conduct of Haitian elites who provide illicit financial and operational support to armed gangs, And they impose a dealings prohibition on them, effectively freezing them any assets they may hold in Canada. Is that not in some sense instances of standing up to those big boys directing things in the country?
Well, I'll put it to you like this, Michael. Imagine it was in Montreal that this was happening. And that it was, the richest person in Canada would have been, a Haitian immigrant, let's say, in Montreal. And then you would find out that this person has been funding terrorists who've been kidnapping Canadians in Montreal, in Toronto, in, Halifax. And then, what would be the punishment for this person? Like they would stop them from trading certain things, or would they arrest them and put them in jail for the rest of their lives? Okay. Mm-hmm. So what we're saying is that this is not even funny, because Gilbert Bigeau, who is said to be the only billionaire of the island, so possibly the richest person of the Caribbean. Okay, so if this person and Canada, the United States, have said that they have information about this guy, not the United States, actually, Canada. See, that's another game that they play. Bigeau is in Florida, but it's Canada that put Bigeau in the list, and the United States doesn't put Bigeau on their own list. But if this person is indeed involved in all of these things, and it's really documented, there are some One of the leaders of those paramilitaries, Arnel Joseph, who before he was killed in February 2021, explained how two oligarch families, namely the Bijous and the Debs, were fighting each other using these terrorists who are called gangs. And they are the ones who get weapons to come in. And Bijo, having been the consulate of Israel for 25 years in Haiti, had diplomatic immunity. He has his own private port that he owned as a joint venture with Michel Martelly. And therefore, these guys were getting weapons, illegal weapons, in the hands of these young folks in the communities. And so you have all of this information. It cannot be, you're absolutely right. It was December 5th, 2022, when Global Affairs Canada put the names of these three white oligarchs. These were the first three white oligarchs ever named because of the pressure from folks, namely in the Haitian community, that kept on saying to Canada, you cannot be saying that you're serious about helping Haiti when even in this particular instance of crisis, you refuse to distance yourself from this white supremacist minority in Haiti that has been, wreaking havoc on the island for decades. And so Bijou is still in Florida living large. His son, Ruben Bijou, who's running his empire, still manages Port Lafitte and all kinds of other assets. And these people are not the ones who are running for their lives or, unable to live normal lives in Haiti. They use helicopters and they fly above all of the mess. And so I'm not sure they're being sanctioned. And there's no one to verify those so-called sanctions. And even if these sanctions were applied, as they were applied after the coup in 1991, there's nothing to show that, they haven't left loopholes for them to circumvent those so-called sanctions. Because we're talking about billionaires among impoverished populations. And so, a simple example. Let's say you have 12 million people in Haiti. They have to eat every day. Okay, Bijou has a monopoly on almost everything that people eat in Haiti, and he's the one importing them. So, what kind of sanctions is going to hurt this guy when, in fact, he's in Florida and the United States has not taken any sanctions against him? Therefore, he can move his money, and there's no sanction against the rest of his family members. These guys have all kinds of tricks in order to circumvent those so-called sanctions.
Yeah, I gotta call you at there, Jean Saint-Ville, but thank you so much for your time and your analysis. So I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Michael, and thank you to Global News Network for doing this. You've been doing amazing work over the years covering Haiti as it should be. Much regards.
Jeffrey Kaiti, AKA Jean Saint-Ville, is an Ottawa-based author, radio host, and social justice activist. Find all his recent writings and broadcasts, including of the podcast God Is Not White, on his website, JAFRIKAYITI.com. That's our show for this week. Next week is our Fun Drive special. Join us then. You're listening to the Global Research NewsHour, a program funded by the Center for Research on Globalization and produced in collaboration with campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on the traditional lands of the Anishinaabe, Innu, Oji-Cree, Dene, and Dakota, the birthplace of the Métis Nation and the heart of the Métis Nation homeland. The show airs on partner radio stations across Canada and the United States and is available for streaming or download at the site globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, please email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I've been your host, Michael Welch. Thanks once again for joining us.